All right, well, hello everyone. This is Danya Koja.
This is Wendy Chang.
And welcome to this month's Critical Decision in Emergency Medicine's podcast. Today we're going to be discussing the May 2018 issue, which is issue 32.5, making it our sixth podcast.
Seven? Oh man, I lost count already.
If you're not familiar with the Clinical Decision in Emergency Medicine publication, then you really need to stop what you're doing right now. And, well, I mean, if you're driving, then just pull off first before you, do this. But otherwise, stop what you're doing and go to the ASAP website, check out the Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine issue. I'm pretty sure that there's one usually available just for you to kind of take a peek and see. And what this publication does, which is ASAP's official CME publication, is that it has two lessons each month to discuss topics in emergency medicine. They can either be part of the bread and butter core curriculum of emergency medicine, or it can be something cutting edge. It can be anywhere from talks to peds to adults to really old adults to whatever it is that you want. And then there's a critical image, a critical EKG, and a talks box, and a drug box.
Don't forget an LSA review, which is so key.
Yes, because then if you read that, you don't have to actually sit around and read an entire article for your LSSA. And, well, technically, yes, you should. and also, there is, I said, critical EKG, critical imaging, critical procedure.
That's right.
So it's a fantastic publication and a great use of your time to get high-yield information, because these lessons are not rambling on and on and on about the topic, but rather they look at the critical decisions that you face when you're in the emergency department dealing with this particular topic.
Exactly. And they're based on the EM model. So a lot of residencies use these as their reading materials. And truthfully, they're just great refreshers on topics or diseases that you don't see often. For example, kids, in my case.
In my case too, Wendy. So I think I see more kids than you do. So
yeah.
I saw a kid last week.
I make it a policy that I do not see any kids. They're in the wrong wing, wrong place.
Hey, I saw one child last week. One.
I saw one in the elevator today, but not a patient. Okay. All right. Well, so moving on to our first article today, I'm alluding to the article Out on a Limb, which is talking about the limping kid. And thanks to Drs. Mike Gardner, Dr. Coburn Allen, Dr. Robert Vizzetti, as well as Dr. Gail Lonergan for writing this article. And it was a great review, of course, of the patient that may or may not walk well and is now limping.
That may or may not walk into your emergency department. So my kid limping is like my peds equivalent of the adult weak and dizzy. Like, I'd much rather take care of a weak and dizzy adult than a child that's limping. I don't know how you feel about it, Wendy.
I agree. I wish I can just MRI and admit.
Well, we'll talk about that, I guess, at some point. So the article starts with a bunch of cases, a kid that was playing and now can't walk, a febrile kid, and then this subacute presentation kid. Let's say this kid comes into the emergency department. What do we do?
All right. I really like how the authors broke it down into the febrile versus afebrile kid with a limp, because, yeah, it's true. Your differential can be different based on whether or not the kid has a fever. Although, you know, they also reminded you that even the afebrile kid with a limp can have, of course, an infectious etiology. So starting with that, then you can go down to a very broad differential of the kid with a limp. And there's a great table for that.
What I remember from peds is that their bones are different. I remember that their growth plate is the weakest spot in the bone, which is why we do all the Salter Harris stuff. Mm-hmm. And then the ligaments are stronger than their bone. So strains and sprains are actually less common than fractures. And I remember that they have rubbery bones.
That's right.
So they can kind of have a fracture but not break it.
Yeah, the whole buckle fracture thing. Yeah.
The way I remember it is how... not related really to our topic today with the limping, but how kiddos can have serious pulmonary trauma without actual rib fractures because, you know, they have rubber chest.
That's right. If only they're actually made of rubber.
They're not.
I know, exactly. Darn. Okay. So one of the disease processes that they mention is the toddler's fracture, which are spiral fractures of the tibia. And this happens in typically, again, a toddler who's learning to walk. And it can actually happen from just even minimal trauma, which okay. is kind of concerning. And the child would present with pain, and their physical exam actually might be normal.
Okay. So basically, if a toddler can't walk and they have a toddler's fracture, like there's nothing I can do on exam to figure it out?
You can actually try, of course, direct palpation, and you might have pain over the fracture site.
Okay.
Or you can do some passive flexion of the foot to see if there's any pain elicited.
Like dorsiflexion or plantar flexion?
Dorsiflexion.
Okay.
Exactly. Yep.
So up towards your nose.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And or the third maneuver is that you can apply a little bit of a twisting force to the tibia through holding their foot and okay. the knee. And if that elicits pain, then this makes it much more likely.
Yeah. So Wendy was just like making this twisting motion with her hand. You know, people can't actually see you on the podcast.
I know,
right?
Exactly. Darn it.
Maybe we should do a video cast.
Next time. Yes.
So let's say you have this patient and you're worried about it. Is the x-ray 100% sensitive?
No, that's the scary part, because as much as 40% of these kids can have normal x-rays.
Wow.
And that's so a it's lot. Really, yeah, exactly. So maybe just skip the x-ray altogether. You don't hear me say that. So I think if your clinical suspicion is high, then treat it as a toddler fracture.
Okay. All right. And then follow up.
Correct. Follow up. Okay. Yes. On a repeat imaging, you can actually get confirmation.
Okay. And I guess that this is a good time for me to remind myself and everybody else is that you should think about non-accidental trauma. Something I remember talking about before, if a kid can't walk, then they can have a toddler's fracture. So when it's 6 months old that has a quote-unquote toddler's fracture, then that's not really possible. They're not right. toddling. So.
Yes, exactly.
All right, so what else you got? In your afebrile, not overtly, clearly having a reason for their limp.
So some other injuries we have to consider with kids are, especially adolescents, they can actually get overuse injuries, and that can often occur along your distal tibia or foot, and you're going to have focal tenderness over these areas. And obviously you have to have a history that fits with the fact that they have an increase in the activity or intense exercise.
Okay, so sort of like stress factors in adults.
Right.
Sort of. Okay.
Yeah, all right. Exactly. And then another one is apophyseal injuries, which is inflammation at where the tendons are inserted into the bone. And so this is where, remember Osgood Schlatter disease?
Okay. Are we going to start listing all these names now?
There are a few names that are specific to these limping kid phenomenon.
So Osgood Schlatter is the one where it's patellar tendon insertion.
Yes.
Hurts. Like basically, so it's like knee pain in your adolescent patient.
Right.
Or exactly. Pre-adolescent. Okay.
Yep.
So do you x-ray these kids? I mean, you can x-ray whoever you want, but
right.
is that helpful?
No. I think the clinical picture, and then you're going to have a physical exam finding that fits it. You can treat them supportively.
Okay.
And then more names. Remember Skiffy?
Oh, yes. Wait. That's the ice cream cone
yeah,
situation.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
So in...
I'm sorry. Slipped ice cream cone.
That's right. The sad case where the actual ice cream is falling off the cone. So these are in your children and adolescents who tend to be overweight or obese, where, like you just described, the femoral epiphysis actually becomes displaced from the femoral neck through the physis.
Okay.
And so oftentimes these kids will present with hip pain or a chronic limp, but they can also have thigh or knee pain as their presenting symptom.
Okay. So, I mean, sometimes it's really obvious with the slipped ice cream cone situation is that you get an x-ray and it's really, really obvious. But I know that sometimes it's subtle, and I know that it's something that we really need to worry about. Well, what can we do with that?
Correct. So these people definitely need more than just an AP view on an x-ray. You're going to need the lateral view, or what we often do is the frog leg view.
And that's the one where you have to compare one side to the other sometimes, right?
Yeah, that can be helpful. And if you remember the Klein's line, you can actually draw a line along the superior femoral neck and see if it intersects the lateral portion of the femoral head.
Okay.
If it doesn't, then you have Skiffy.
Yep. And if you are worried at any point in time, you can always Google.
Yes.
Klein's lines.
For most measurements on an x-ray, Google is my friend.
For a lot of things, Google is my friend. So with these kiddos, do they have to go emergently to surgery, or all you need to do is just diagnose them and have them see their doctor?
Oh, they need emergency surgery only if you have a complete slip or acute symptoms less than 3 weeks.
Sounds good. So, more names. What other names do you have for me?
Next is the leg-calf paresthesis. This is an idiopathic osteonecrosis of the hip, and this often happens in your younger group, so younger than your SCIFI group. So this is like age 3 to 12 or so.
Kids can present with knee pain when it's referred from the hip, so please look at both.
Exactly.
That is not in the paper, but you know.
Good tip for sure. So we've talked a bit about traumatic injuries as well as these very classic age group findings. We do also have to talk a little bit about the bad stuff, which is tumors.
So what tumors? Are we talking about malignant or benign tumors?
You can have benign and malignant tumors involving the bone. Benign osteomas are most common in teenagers, and they can have nocturnal pain and that response to NSAIDs. Whereas malignant tumors, when you're thinking about Ewing sarcomas or osteosarcomas, a nocturnal pain is, of course, a general red flag that we think about with malignancies in general. But these patients may also have systemic symptoms.
And how about leukemia?
The scary thing about leukemia is that 43% of these patients actually have bone pain as one of their presenting symptoms. And so you got to think about it if a kid is coming in with pain, a limp, as well as potentially some of the other findings like pallor, petechiae, ecchymoses, etc.
All right, so I remember that when we started talking about this, you said, all right, like the branching point number one in the decision making is febrile versus afebrile.
Yep.
So is it time to talk about the fever kids?
Yes. Our biggest dilemma, I think, when we're dealing with a febrile kid with a limp is trying to figure out if the kid may have septic arthritis or just transient tenosynovitis.
So how are we able to figure that out?
Well, clinically, they can present, like we already said, with a fever and the limp, which is tough. They may have the hip pain, etc., not willing to bear weight. And there is actually a diagnostic criteria that can be quite helpful. You can look at whether or not the patient has a fever greater than 38.5, if they are actually refusing to bear weight, if they have a white blood cell count greater than 12,000, or ESR greater than 40. If you have none of these criteria, then it's pretty unlikely to have a septic arthritis.
Okay, so fever, refusal, complete refusal to bear weight, high white count, high ESR. How about CRP?
CRP is also a good predictor of septic arthritis. And what the authors mentioned is a CRP greater than 2.
Sounds like this is really simple. What are other ones that can cause febrile limping?
Well, really, you have to think about all sorts of soft tissue infections. So
okay.
Whether it's myositis, osteomyelitis, discitis,
okay.
Really anything.
Well, what is myositis? We don't tend to see myositis a lot in adults. I mean, we see it as an extension of cellulitis or fasciitis from that standpoint, but just good old myositis, we don't see that in adults. What is it like in children?
Well, I learned that viral myositis is really common with influenza and actually affects the calves. And so these patients might present with what is quote unquote the Charlie Chaplin gait.
All right. So I guess that if I can't figure out what the gait is like, I can just Google a video of Charlie Chaplin.
You should do that. But if you wanted to envision it right now, they have their toes pointed out and they're shuffling so that they don't have to actually stretch their calf muscles.
And that's viral myositis. So it's just conservative therapy kind of thing.
Correct. Yes.
Got it. With adults, I know that with, you know, all of these bacterial things, you look for hotness, tenderness, redness. I don't think it's much different in kids, right?
Right, exactly. I think the big thing is that bone and joint infections are actually more common in kids because of the fact that these are, you know, typically hematogenous spread.
How about non-infectious febrile etiologies for limping?
Don't forget your inflammatory disease processes or rheumatological disease processes. So think about if you have multiple joints being involved, other classic rashes, etc.
So to summarize this, kiddo comes in and you need to figure out if they're febrile or not febrile, which is kind of somewhat easy. However, we do need to remember that sometimes people with the typically febrile illnesses will present without a fever. And then do a thorough exam. Everybody needs to be naked so you can look at all of their joints and all of their limbs, and then try to localize the location of the tenderness. However, you know, if they're really young, if they're less than five, you may have to actually x-ray an entire extremity or look bilaterally at things if you can't figure out what is normal for them, like tip, fib, and femur. And then if you are worried about a hip involvement in a febrile child, remember the criteria to help you differentiate. If you can't even figure out if somebody has a hip effusion, then you can cheat and do an ultrasound. And I did not hear you say the word CT, not even once. So I'm guessing we don't CT children the way we CT adults. So
I like to avoid them, correct.
And the only ones that we admit, the acute surgical ones for the SCFEs, and of course, if non-accidental trauma ones.
Right.
And ones who need further workup or further intervention, like IV antibiotics. And of course, if we have any concerns over, you know, malignancy.
Yeah, because generally if the kid is feeling well after you give him some analgesia and is able to walk, that's obviously a big important thing. If they walked in, they need to walk out, then they can go home and have outpatient follow-up.
Well, thank you so much, Wendy, for going through this limpy article. So the procedure for this month, the critical procedure, is an auricular hematoma IND, basically how to prevent the cauliflower ear. So it's written out in a very simple way, something that you are going to need to do when you're out in the community by yourself. So,
if nothing else, the picture of the ear with all the anatomical parts labeled is a great refresher.
I agree. The LSA article review is about managing suicidal patient, which we all know is something that is on the rise. We are all seeing more psych patients. There's a lot more focus on psych patients. So hopefully this article, one, is going to help you in your clinical practice, but also help you through your LSA article review. And now my favorite article in this whole issue, which I'm completely 100% biased. And I admit it. I love old people. One, the article is called Bitter Pill, which is adverse drug events in geriatric patients. So that is one reason I like it. And number two, it is written by one of our former grads, Dr. Tui Von Pham. Or Von! So Von graduated our program and she's now up in Washington State. The article talks about how old people actually have adverse drug events.
What?
I know, it sounds crazy.
Mind blown. I mean, aren't old people just older kids?
Well, they're older adults. No. So
they're a lot like kids, to be honest.
That is true. So I think that that is one of my biggest passions in geriatric emergencies, is that we have learned really well that kids are not just smaller adults. But for some reason, we can't appreciate that geriatric patients are not just older adults. There's a lot of things about them that are different. So the way they process medications in their body is different. You probably remember the pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics and all these things. So because their body composition is different, they have more fat and less water than their younger counterparts, then the metabolism of drugs is different. They're more likely to have comorbidities. So if they're more likely to have kidney dysfunction, then of course they're going to have a different metabolism of renally excreted drugs. And then the other thing about them is that to begin with, they have different disease processes than their younger counterparts. So I just think it's completely insane that we try to use all what we know about medications in young patients and just apply it to old people. So they're definitely very different.
Very true. Okay. What else? What else adds to considerations of adverse drug events in this population?
So one of the other things is they are a lot more likely than their younger counterparts to have multiple medications on board, so, which is what we call polypharmacy. So if you look at the numbers, it's actually shocking. 10% of older patients, as in patients over the age of 65, are on at least five prescription medications, if not more. And that's not even counting the over-the-counter medications, the herbal medications, and so on, which can get really confusing, right? If you have five different medications, at least, that you're trying to take every day, then your likelihood that you're going to even take it correctly is low. The likelihood that you have duplicates is really high, and I'm sure every single one of us identifies with that. When your patient comes in with their medication bag, yes, you know, the plastic bag that has the meds in it.
And they always have three bottles of the same thing.
Yes. And the problem, it's not just, you know, when they are all the same thing and they are able to tell you, oh, this is the same one, it's kind of okay. But when it's like metoprolol and toprol, and you're like, I don't know if you get that those are the same one.
It's true.
And then the other thing is that with a lot of our patients, if they have any issues with their vision, if they're hearing, keeping track of their paperwork even, they're not going to really know what to do with their medications. It's pretty interesting that around 1/4 to 1/2 of elderly patients don't actually take the medication instructions as they are received. And 2/3 of them, it's just because they don't want to do it that way. If you give an older person a medication that they're supposed to take 4 times a day, imagine that with a whole bunch of other medicines on board.
Yeah, it's true. Absolutely.
And then finally, what also happens is that we're really good at prescription cascades. So, you know, the person is on an ACE inhibitor, so we prescribe them Teflon pearls for the cough. And then we wonder why they have so many medications. So that's one of the extra things that make it very difficult in older patients to keep track of their medications.
Okay, so what do we do in the ED?
The reason this is very relevant to our ED practice is, one, sometimes we are the ones who are starting this polypharmacy. But two, we actually see adverse drug events rather often. Studies out there say that 10% of hospital admissions are caused by adverse drug events, which means that if you just close your eyes, again, not if you're driving, but and think of the last 10 patients above the age of 65 that you saw, one of them was there at least partly because of an adverse drug event. And if you don't remember diagnosing that, then guess what? You missed it. And that's kind of scary because if you can't figure it out, then you can't fix it.
Are there any specific medications that we have to be most attuned to?
So there's actually a lot of medications that we can be attuned to. And there's a bunch of medications that we know are the most common ones causing side effects, which are Coumadin, insulin, and digoxin. And these three are the top three causing side effects all over. Now, if you're trying to kind of be a little more nuanced and figure out, is this medicine that I want to give my patient okay for them? Then there's a bunch of resources out there. This particular paper really harps on the American Geriatric Society's list, which is called the Beers List. And their 2015 update is actually pretty decent. I'm not a huge fan of the prior issues because they were very difficult to use in the emergency department. But the Beers List is great. You can Google it, download the PDF, and just look at the medications there. And basically, they tell you what medications you're absolutely not supposed to use or medications you should use with caution, and it explains to you why. And I think that although in all reality, we don't always have the time to do this in our emergency department, that is one thing that having one and a dedicated pharmacist would really help out with.
So key, yes.
Yes. We are very blessed that we do have fantastic ED pharmacists here in RED, but I know that that's not the case everywhere. And then the other thing is just take an extra 30 seconds and go through the medication list with your patient. Sometimes it's more than 30 seconds. I'm very well aware. That's what med students are for. And then you can basically just figure out what is it that you can or cannot give this person.
Absolutely. I know it may not be our favorite part of taking care of the patient in the ED, but doing that actual medication reconciliation is absolutely key.
Definitely, especially in patients that are older. If I got a dollar for every single time one of the patients said, oh, you can read my medication list on the computer, I would be rich. But you know what would make me even richer? When the rest of the team says okay to that idea.
Very true.
I mean, I work at night, so I don't have the luxury of actually working clinically with our ED pharmacists who do a fantastic job of identifying our high-risk patients and actually going through that with them. But I think that's definitely something that can help us change our practice and decrease the number of drug events or adverse events that happen to our patient because of, iatrogenically, because of us.
Are there any other ways that we can reduce these adverse drug events?
Reduce the drugs you give your patients? So in the ED, that's not necessarily very applicable, but something they do in the clinic, which I found very interesting, is that they sit there and they literally strip down the medication list for patients. So patients would walk in with a 15 item medication list, and they would walk out with 7.
That's awesome.
You know what? If you're 85, I'm not really looking to change your 10-year mortality at this point, right?
Right.
I want you to be comfortable.
Yeah.
Maybe you should not be taking that anti-hyperlipidemic. If this medicine is making you dizzy and fall at home, it's okay for blood pressures on the higher side.
Right.
Guess what? It's worse if you fall when you're on Coumadin, and so on.
It's very true. Okay. All right. So the elderly population are not just older adults.
Thank you, Wendy.
And we have a lot to consider when we're dealing with their medications because of their different pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics, etc. All those fancy numbers and equations. Also because simply with their comorbidities, there's a high risk for polypharmacy. And so we definitely need to do our part in when we prescribe medications to reduce adverse drug reactions by consulting something like the Beers List or any other resources your hospital may have.
Your pharmacist.
Yes. Call up your pharmacy department. They can help. I do that often. And the most important thing, I think, is just to really review the medications that the patient is on with, though, to make sure they understand what they're taking, that you have the accurate list so that you can take care of them appropriately.
Thank you, Wendy, for listening to my rant and my spiel about older patients. Apparently, you didn't fall asleep while I was talking, so thank you.
Awesome. Great lessons. Don't forget to check out the other parts of this issue, which includes the critical image, reviewing hip x-rays, and the fact that you should not only look for traumatic injuries, but also look for other pathologies like lytic lesions, etc. Also, the critical EKG this month is a great refresher on the morphology differences between wide complex tachycardias, trying to differentiate between VTAC versus other tachycardias with aberrancy.
And for the tox box this month, there is the amnestic shellfish poisoning, which, as much as I wanted it to be, you cannot blame shellfish for having amnesia and pretending that you forgot to do things. Apparently, you can eat mussels and clams that contain a neurotoxin. See, neuro, that's your part.
Mussels in the Pacific Northwest. Did you see the news?
No.
They're detecting opiates in them.
In the mussels?
Yeah.
Okay. I definitely missed that, but that I know exactly what I'm going to look for right now after I'm done with this podcast. Hey, maybe that is why they're having amnesia. The opioids. So basically, with amnestic shellfish poisoning, roughly around like 5 hours or less after your ingestion, you're going to have a bunch of GI complaints and you're going to think, oh, it's just I had some bad mussels. However, the big thing is that you would have neurological symptoms like seizures and cranial nerve palsies and comas, which sound very uncomfortable and, you know, bad. And basically, there's not much that you can do for these patients. It's just supportive care and treat their seizures and wish them luck, because apparently they may have long-term effects.
I will be sure to add that to my review of systems.
Did you eat mussels today?
For my next
seizure patient.
Exactly.
And then finally, last but not least, our drug box today is about biotin or vitamin B7, which, although it is a very rare deficiency, it is definitely something that is important to make sure that you take. However, let's all remember that study after study after study shows that if there is absolutely nothing wrong with you, then vitamins and minerals are useless as supplements.
Correct.
I guess this was our issue for this month. We talked about the limping kid. I went on a monologue about geriatric patients. I had the auricular hematoma IND, the hip x-ray as an image, the wide complex tachycardias as an EKG, and I think that's enough knowledge for one day.
As always, we enjoy reviewing these articles with you. We love to hear any great clinical cases or questions.
And you can definitely connect with us on our Twitter accounts. Mine is at Danya Koja.
Mine is at EM_NCC.
And until next month, take care.
Bye-bye.